Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gallagher.
Pleasure to be here.
And there's obviously a lot of, well, I don't want to be too cynical in terms of the country congratulating itself about how a terrible racist has had this public downfall. But so much of what happened to Donald Sterling was in effect at the rhetorical level, since it came from a surreptitiously recorded conversation with his mistress, and it expressed his personal views. But isn't there a gulf between the rhetoric of racism and the reality of racism?
Well, I think that's exactly it. And I think what happened with Sterling is that the curtain was pulled back on people that know the drill. Most people in positions of power understand that you cannot engage in racist language, anything that's perceived to be socially inappropriate, in public. You can do it in private. You can do it when you're around people that are like-minded with your own people. You can do it with your mistress if you believe you're not being tape recorded. But what I think is interesting is that what was picked up is a conversation that happens hundreds of thousands of times in people's living rooms and people's workrooms when they're around people that are the same race as themselves. So I'm not shocked by this. It's just that he got caught saying it.
So how deep-seated, then, is racial prejudice in America?
Well, you know what I think, Ian, is that, you know, and I'm in the middle of a new project now where I'm interviewing a number of whites across the age spectrum in four different neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And, you know, once the tape recorder gets running, people let down. They let down their guard. And, you know, if I had to characterize the United States simply, I'd say that there are three Americas. And the first population, which I think is relatively small, are people that kind of get it. They understand the historical legacy of race and racism. They understand institutional racism. And they understand that cities look the way they do, schools are structured and resources the way they are, because of our 300 years of institutional racism. And so people get it. And I think the next category are people that have learned to be tolerant, at least ostensibly, but they broker in stereotypes of blacks or Mexicans or Asians. And they know the drill also, because at work they know that they're not allowed to engage certain behaviors because it breaks the law. But in their own private spaces, these folks basically will go right to the stereotypes, right to the kind of the kinds of ugly things we say about other groups. And then I think the third group are people like Sterling. I think that the guy Bundy, Cliveden. And I think that these folks are just old school racists in many ways. And I think if you look at the second and third group, that's the majority of the United States. And I think we congratulate ourselves on the back. We tried out this notion of colorblindness because we have a black president. Yet every quality of life indicator points that race still matters enormously in the United States.
So how much, then, is this an historical fact that there's always been this kind of ghettoization in the United States? And, you know, we have here in Los Angeles, where, of course, Sterling lives in Beverly Hills, but he grew up on the east side, which is the poorer and multiracial part of town. And, you know, most of the African-Americans and Latinos live in the east and the whites live in the west. And then if you go back through our history in New York, you know, the Irish had their ghetto, the Jews had their ghettos. But the difference was, it seems, in earlier parts of our history, you know, notwithstanding the Civil War and of course, the hideous of slavery, there seems to have been more social mobility. So is this really an issue of social mobility?
Well, I think what's happening is that I think you're right in that there's an element of social mobility. And what's happened is that for much of the middle class, the rug has been pulled out. So where whites could, many whites, in Philadelphia is a good example, you could drop out of high school in the 1970s and walk into a factory or a mill and get a job that paid a living wage where you could buy a row house. Those days are over. So I think a lot of whites that are at economic margins are scrambling as well. And of course, everyone, the way it works is the kind of like pecking order, the queue is such that if you're a racial minority, you're always going to be below, you're going to be lowest in the queue. So I think that we are segregating by, if you look at quintiles of income, we are segregating by income. And income and race are very highly correlated. And so these things are happening, but at the same time, what you have happening is resegregation of our cities. Our schools are more segregated than they were in the 1960s in many American cities. And what that really is about is that whites basically continuing not to want to live even in the smallest percent of neighborhoods where there's a non-white population. So for most whites, once you get to 10% black, the tipping point has happened. There's a psychological tipping point, and most whites will not buy a house in that neighborhood, and the whites that live there will start to think about moving out. And then once they move out, it's classic white flight. So income plays out, but again, race becomes, race is in some kind of secondary feature of class. It plays in and of itself as a variable.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sun Belt. So given these facts, though, we're also told, Charles, that the millennials, the younger generation between 20 and 30, are post-racial and post-sexual in terms of their hang-ups over homosexuality. So how do you factor that in at the same time as we discuss there's less social mobility? So I'm wondering how much we're in denial about a bigger issue, and that is class. And I think to some extent, Sterling was one of those billionaires whose arrogance was so obvious was because he had so much money. I mean, he had a plantation mentality. It's true he had an antediluvian racial view of African Americans, but at the same time he had this patronizing, I'm the job creator kind of mentality.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think that he's a unique character. I mean, this man has a history of engaging in racist behavior, and he was brought to the courts about this, about what he was doing with his tenants. So he doesn't like Mexicans, he doesn't like blacks, and he acted that way. So not only is he prejudiced, but he's an actual discriminator. So, I mean, this man, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, if he's forced to sell his team, he's going to go from buying something for $12 million and selling it for possibly $1 billion. So I think it's ironic how basically people at the top can basically maintain their privilege. But I mean, back to your original point about the younger generation, they are more tolerant if you believe in survey data. And the bottom line is that more people are not upset about someone black and white or white and brown marrying. People say live and let live. But again, the numbers are very small. We're talking about like 6% of the population. But that said, what has happened, and I think how the colorblind narrative plays out, people don't say that blacks are such and such because of biological reasons, that the kind of old Jim Crow racism that was grounded in, first the Bible and then science, that's been thrown out. What's replaced it is culture. And that's a narrative that people can say, well, I have black friends and they're like me, we're both in college, they're okay. But when I drive through North Philadelphia or a barrio, those folks have problems. They're the architects of their own demise because of the culture that they basically have passed on to their children. So it becomes a culture of poverty argument has emerged again among these kids. And they're able to discern good blacks from bad blacks. And all this does is kind of reify and recreate another version of us and them. So you're right. I mean, if you're an upper middle class kid, and you're in a white suburban high school and you have a black friend next to you, the likelihood is that kid's going to come from a background that's similar to yours and you'll have a lot in common. Driving through the city is a different deal. And again, once you do that, you can start saying, what's wrong with this kid? Why do they live this way without any understanding of American history? And I think that's the danger.
But in terms of us being a class society, and we have the 1%, and we have the 1% of the 1% who have an inordinate wealth. Just one family, the Waltons, have the wealth equivalent to 40% of the lower end of American families, which is an extraordinary statistic. So, it seems to me that when we talk about race, we forget that there are more white people in poverty, more white people on welfare, and more white people on food stamps.
Right. There are more white, there are more poor white people than any other group in the United States. The big difference is that white poverty is diffuse. It's dispersed. It's in the city, it's in the suburb, and it's in rural places. Black and brown poverty is overwhelmingly concentrated in very, very tight parts of urban areas. So it's very visible. It becomes visible in the news. So, of course, this cements another stereotype about people on welfare, people that are poor, and that being associated with brown and black. And you have to, so it's also interesting, if you look at black family households that make $75,000, they are more segregated. So imagine, we're talking about $75,000. That's way over the median family income. Blacks at that income level are more segregated than poor whites. So even blacks that are doing well tend to live in all-black neighborhoods where they typically have less social services, the schools aren't as good. So even when you control for class, and I would argue, you know, the United States, we always say there is no class here. We're not like the UK, right? We threw off those shackles. We don't talk about class in the United States, because if you talk about class in the United States, what you're also talking about is a system that's rigged. You know, Ian, I always tell my students, they don't understand it at first, I always say to them, pick your parents well. You know, of course, they don't understand. And then they realize, you know, what does it mean to come from an upper middle class neighborhood where your parents have enormous amounts of resources to invest in you? So class and race are tied together in the United States, but all of it gets washed over by this bootstrapping notion that anybody can make it in the United States. And case in point is Barack Obama.
Well, just in closing, though, it would seem to me, and a lot of people I've had on my program have made this argument, that in many ways it's the Republicans who are keeping racism alive, because it's the glue that keeps white men in particular voting for them because of their fear of this demographic change that's underway.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that a lot of people are cheering recent decisions of the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is full of folks that believe we've turned the corner on race. I think it's interesting, the Voting Rights Act, there was discussion, you know, this is no longer needed because municipalities don't discriminate anymore. The whole discussion about affirmative action is a perfect example of basically pandering to a very, very small base. You know, I'm sure you've talked about affirmative action, you know, what's going on with a court case in Michigan. Here you have a system where they include where you're from, the region you're from, the state you're from, if you're from a family of poverty, if you're international, if you play a music instrument, if you're gifted, if you've done community service. They privilege people if they're male or female. They privilege people if they're on a sports team. They absolutely privilege legacies. It's the most powerful helping hand to get into an elite school. Of all these variables, everybody freaks out about race. You have to think to yourself, why is it all these other things that people do to have a diverse student body, why is it one variable makes white American males in particular, apoplectic? And I think what you do is you throw these bones, these dog whistles get sounded, and they become something that pulls the troops together. And I think you're absolutely right. The problem is they're running out of things to feed this, you know, white males make up about 35% of the population. And in many ways, if you look at Fortune 100 companies and you look at vice president above, 95-94% of those people are white males, yet they only constitute 35% of the population. And these folks at the top, they don't care about these issues. These issues are basically put out there for white males that are failing economically, that'll never live the life of their grandparents or never have the mobility of their fathers. And I think this is the way you keep the troops together. You give them these cultural little pieces of, I guess they're crumbs, right, to keep them basically in the party.
Well, Charles Gallagher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome, Ian. Nice talking to you again.
Good talking to you again, Charles. Again, I've been speaking with Charles Gallagher. He's a professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sun Belt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.